this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Why Can't We All Just Get Along? Zoning Issues Pit Developers Against Neighborhoods as Triangle Grows. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. Protests can erupt fast, threatening huge deals. Developers have learned to prepare in age of social media. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. Flanked by a crowd of John Cain supporters with big yellow Vote Yes stickers affixed to their sport coats and button-downs, Midtown Raleigh homeowner Will Yudusky and several of his neighbors stood stoic at the back of the Raleigh City Council chamber with handmade signs urging the council to rethink Cain Realty's latest rezoning plan at North Hills. It was one of the few times, Yudusky says, he has ever protested anything so publicly. It's fairly certain that my own property value will vault during the period of this case's build-out, Yudusky admits, so I probably wouldn't care about this case if I wasn't a friend of the folks at the end of the proverbial spear, referring to his neighbors closest to the Cain property land. Cain's team had made several concessions and improvements during their months of meetings with neighbors related to building setbacks and traffic improvements, but Yudusky says the changes were still deficient of city ordinance and that he and his neighbors felt their hands were tied in pleading their case to city leaders. Emails and signs at meetings are about the only way for common folk to speak truth to power, he says. That tense meeting where one of Raleigh's top developers squared off against his neighbors showed how quickly and forcefully the public can respond to development plans, and how developers have to be prepared for those actions. Compared to their not-in-my-backyard parents of the past, today's neighborhood activist is much more likely to be informed, educated, and ready to mobilize. Future land use maps are available for study online. Social media portals and websites disseminate information more broadly and quickly than going door-to-door and holding neighborhood coffees. And the sophistication with which neighborhood activism in the Triangle has grown even helped a leader of a North Raleigh rezoning opposition group, David Cox, get elected to the City Council in October 2015. Real estate developers, sometimes eyed with suspicion by their neighbors, have begun organizing neighborhood meetings much earlier in the planning process to generate early support, identify potential red flags, and ward off misinformation that might jeopardize an affirmative vote. That has led overall to a smoother process. It's what Raleigh leaders hoped would happen when they made changes to how development projects are evaluated and approved, plus additional tweaks, pending a task force report on April 18, recommending changes to how citizens can get involved. Members of the public have learned quite a bit the last few years about the land use process in Raleigh and how it works, says Lacey Reeves, a veteran land use lawyer and partner at the Smith Anderson Law Firm in Raleigh. There's still emotion in dealing with land use, but it doesn't seem as reactionary or as emotional as it did at one time. But those emotions can flare up, and quickly, emotions that can put development projects worth millions of dollars in jeopardy. Grocery site controversies. Grocery-anchored projects in particular have been a sensitive source of consternation. Grocers like Publix, Harris Teeter, and Lidl are expanding into the Triangle, searching for pockets of land near established neighborhoods. Since many of the best corner sites were built out years ago, they're left with few options for growth. A battle between a North Raleigh neighborhood group against the developers of a proposed Publix grocery store on Dunn Road in 2015, for example, got so much attention that the International Council of Shopping Centers Trade Organization issued an 11-page white paper about, quote, sensible retail zoning, unquote, for neighborhood shopping centers. The paper warned Raleigh leaders that if more restrictive zoning provisions were allowed, grocers like Kroger, Harris Teeter, and Publix almost certainly would not be able to compete effectively in the city of Raleigh. In Durham, the city council is scheduled in June to consider a controversial rezoning case that has drawn heated discussions from all sides. A Florida development firm representing Publix wants to build a new retail and housing development called North River Village at the corner of Guess and Ladder Roads in North Durham. Some neighbors, however, argue that a new grocer is not needed and will only increase traffic. Patrick Biker, a land use lawyer at Morningstar Law Group in Durham, who represents the developer, says neighbors opposed to the plan are being irrational with their requests and that it has been nearly 20 years since any new retail was added to that part of Durham. That corner cries out for something, Biker says. Others disagree. Julia Monley Plord, who lives four houses down from the site, says she was blissfully ignorant of how the city's rezoning process worked until she received notice of the rezoning petition. It's definitely been a learning experience, she says. We're not irrational people. We know that change is inevitable, but this project is just not inspiring to me, she says. It's a wooded lot zoned for 12 home sites now, and that's fine with us. Plord is part of a group that calls itself the North Durham Quality Development Association, seeking to mobilize opposition to the project. The Durham Planning Commission in February voted 11-2 against recommendation of a rezoning request for a center, but Biker says his group intends to push forward with a public hearing and city council vote in the summer. A spokeswoman for Publix declined to discuss the Durham case. Changes rules for challengers. After the state in 2015 eliminated protest petitions, many neighborhood group leaders complained that the law would make it harder for their voices to be heard. The state had previously required a rezoning request get a supermajority of affirmative votes from the council if a valid protest petition had been filed. But without the law, fewer council members would need to be persuaded by lobbyists for the developer. Raleigh City Council appointed in September a 9-member citizen engagement task force to evaluate ways to improve the communication process and make it easier for citizens to stay informed, attend meetings, and get involved. The plan presented to the council on April 18 includes dozens of recommendations, from changing meeting times for the Planning Commission to the evening when more people can attend, to overhauling the existing Citizen Advisory Council structure to get more residents involved. Retired Raleigh Planning Director George Chapman, who served on the Citizen Engagement Task Force, says the city used to review as many as 200 rezoning petitions a year. Now the number is down to an average of 35 petitions per year. What has helped, he says, was the completion of the city's multi-year, multi-stage overhaul of its zoning and planning rules with the adoption of the 2030 Comprehensive Plan, a new unified development ordinance, and complete UDO rezoning remapping of more than 35,000 property parcels citywide in 2014. They're trying to make the process more transparent, more predictable, he says. But even then, unpredictability is still there. Andy Andrews, a Raleigh developer who has been involved in multiple office and multifamily projects across North Carolina and Virginia, says the complexity of the rezoning case can vary greatly depending on the project. If it's got a lot of hair on it, it's going to be harder, he says. I've had a lot of experience in rezoning. We've developed in 9 cities. I wouldn't say that Raleigh is incredibly easy or incredibly difficult. It does give the citizens a chance to voice their opinion. I would say we're fair, and that's all a developer can ask for is to be fair. Kane, the North Hills developer and chairman and CEO of Kane Realty, that has built much of the nearly $1 billion in new commercial, residential, and retail development around North Hills over the past 15 years, says he always expects that some neighbors will oppose his plans. It comes with the territory, he says. For the St. Albans Drive rezoning case that was approved unanimously at the April 18 City Council meeting, Kane points out that the residents of the Midtown CAC territory had voted nearly 2-1 in favor of the project in January. We made a number of compromises, and I think the compromises we made were appropriate, but that land was not going to stay vacant forever, he says. Sometimes people don't like change. And along with this article, there's a listing of the top 5 most notable rezoning requests in Raleigh. Case Z413, location New Hope and Buffalo Roads, request rezone 6.17 acres from residential to neighborhood business to allow a 24-hour Sheetz gas station. Result denied. Raleigh planning staff ruled the project was consistent with the comprehensive plan and future land use map. Neighbors filed a valid protest petition. The Raleigh Planning Commission voted 6-3 to recommend approval. Raleigh City Council voted unanimously to deny it based upon vocal opposition from neighbors who did not think a gas station was an appropriate fit. A site plan for the same property was submitted in 2017 proposing a new little grocery store. Case Z114, location Falls of Neuse and Dunn Roads. Request rezone 13.12 acres from buffer commercial and residential to NX3 CU that allows for 58,000 square feet of retail or office development or maximum 161 residential units. Result withdrawn. The North CAC members voted 522-23 to deny support for the petition in June 2014, and neighbors filed 4 valid protest petitions. Raleigh planning staff ruled the project was consistent with the comprehensive plan and future land use map. The Raleigh Planning Commission recommended approval in February 2015 after proposed density was reduced. The applicant, a developer group representing Publix, withdrew the petition on May 11, 2015, the day before its city council hearing. Case Z1614 at 530 Varsity Drive. The request to rezone 2.86 acres from neighborhood mixed use that limit the structure to 4 stories to residential development up to 5 stories. Result denied. Raleigh planning staff ruled the proposed 5-story apartment building met comprehensive plan and future land use map guidelines, but the council voted against it in April 2015 after concerns about the building facing Avent Ferry Road and its lack of first floor retail and pedestrian amenities. Update, in 2016, a similar petition was filed with conditions that include up to 3,000 square feet of commercial space, plus additional building setback from the roads, and a 210-unit cap on residential units. The council approved the petition on March 21, 2017. Case Z4115 at 3101 Hillsborough Street. The request to rezone 3.22 acres from commercial use up to 3 stories high to neighborhood mixed use up to 4 stories high for the proposed development of a 506-unit student housing project. Result denied. The Wade CAC members voted 22-3 in December 2015 to deny support for the petition and voted again in January 2015 with a 15-10 vote against its endorsement. Raleigh planning staff ruled the project was consistent with the future land use map, but it was incompatible with the surrounding area. City Council voted 4-2 against approval in April 2016. The developer plans to instead build an apartment project that fits within the guidelines of the existing zoning. And case Z716 at 1522 Jones Franklin Road to rezone 0.9 acre from residential to office mixed use with 3 stories. The result was denied. The case involved an anti-abortion group's request to move next to an abortion clinic by rezoning for commercial use the property adjacent to the clinic. The West CAC members voted 30-17 to endorse the petition. Raleigh planning staff ruled the project was consistent with the comprehensive plan and future land use map. The Raleigh Planning Commission voted unanimously to recommend approval. The Raleigh City Council voted in July 2016 to deny the request, noting that a small office wouldn't be the best use for the site. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, Women's Soccer Makes Another Run at the Triangle. A big crowd is expected April 22 when the Triangle makes another run at women's professional soccer as the North Carolina Courage play at Wake Med Soccer Park at 7:30 p.m. Entrepreneur Steve Malik is pursuing a Major League Soccer expansion team. As part of bolstering soccer in the area, he purchased the Western New York Flash and moved the team, which won last year's National Women's Soccer League title, to the Triangle. The Courage won its first game at Washington and should be one of the league's better teams. North Carolina FC president Kurt Johnson says the women's team has generated a lot of excitement and he expects close to a sellout for the opener at the 10,000-seat stadium. Women's soccer has failed in the past. The WUSA launched after the dramatic American victory in the 1999 World Cup, but the league, which included the Carolina Courage and the Triangle, folded from financial pressure after 3 years. Johnson says the NWSL learned from the harsh lessons of the WUSA. The minimum salary is $15,000, and the salary cap for a team is just north of $300,000. The WUSA, by comparison, had a salary cap of $800,000 in its first season. You have to take a long-term view, Johnson says. There's nothing that is going to happen overnight that is going to create a successful long-term league. The business model has to provide that opportunity, and the NWSL business model is built around getting talented players and the best talent in the world while creating a runway of expenses for owners that can be replicated year after year. The league also has a national television deal on the Lifetime Network for a game every Saturday afternoon. North Carolina FC is hoping the interest in the Courage will show MLS that the market is worthy of having the top men's league. What's going to differentiate us, Johnson says, is our soccer culture. At the end of the day, they're looking for soccer people. He cooks up a sweet ride in fundraiser. After 16 rounds of stiff competition, Catering Works executive chef Rich Carter walked away with the win and the grand prize of a restored 1969 Corvette convertible at the Cooking for a Classic fundraising event benefiting the Lucy Daniel Center. The event raised more than $80,000 over the course of the 8-week challenge. Carter defeated chef Troy Stauffer of City Club Raleigh in the final round for the win on April 10. Typewriter project lands at Raleigh's North Hills. A public art installation called the Typewriter Project, the subconscious of the city, has landed in North Hills via New York City. The installation consists of a booth, vintage typewriter, 100-foot scroll, and USB kit for online sharing, according to Kane Realty. It's open to the public through April 30 and encourages passersby to contribute to an ongoing poem meant to reflect the subconscious of the city. April is National Poetry Month. Our events team, Midtown Events, identified a really cool art project to bring to the property to provide an element of serendipity and public art, says Kane Realty's Bonner Gaylord, the general manager of North Hills. Quail Ridge Books agreed to sponsor the project. Gaylord notes it's the first time the project has ventured outside of New York. According to the Typewriter Project, it's a program of the Poetry Society of New York, producers of the Poetry Brothel, and the New York City Poetry Festival. Backing out of the less-than-friendly skies, Sheldon Wolitzki, founder and CEO of the Select Group, is among those boycotting United Airlines following an incident where a flyer was forcibly removed from a flight in Chicago. Great companies with a focus on a world-class customer experience sometimes make mistakes, he said. The measure of these companies is best seen in how they respond to situations where they have let their customers down. United Airlines' recent actions of forcibly removing a passenger from a flight were shocking and disheartening. The company says that about $250,000 of its more than $1 million travel spend is with United. Budding entrepreneurs compete for a California trip. It could be a life-changing event for a few Triangle Area high school students on April 23. Tie Carolinas, which is part of the Tie Global organization, is hosting a startup competition for 5 Triangle teams. The teams are required to come up with an innovative idea to go along with a comprehensive business rollout plan. The program is part of Tie's Young Entrepreneurship Program. High school students go through a selection process during the year to get enrolled in a 20-week mentoring session led by university professors and business leaders from the Triangle area. 5 teams are then chosen to present their plans. The winning team then advances to the TIE Global Competition in Los Angeles later this year. TIE has 67 chapters across 18 countries. She believes in bees and is showing Triangle Y. Some of the largest companies in the Triangle are starting to jump on the bandwagon of the beehive revolution. Bee Downtown, spelled B-E-E, founder, Lee Catherine Bonner, has sent a note that her startup that began with 24 honeybee hive installs on top of buildings and at corporate campuses across Durham and Raleigh last year are getting ready to expand their flight range. She has sponsor commitments so far from companies like IBM, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, SAS, and Bandwidth to install close to 50 new hives over the next couple of weeks around NC State University's Centennial Campus and at a number of area corporate headquarters. Each sponsoring business will participate in employee education trainings on bees and food production. And now we turn to On Retail and Real Estate, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline: Raleigh developers introduce new age-restricted pocket neighborhoods in Clayton. A Triangle real estate development team, inspired by pocket neighborhoods they had studied and visited in Washington State's Puget Sound region, will be introducing their first age-restricted pocket neighborhood development in Clayton, The Walk at East Village. The first model homes for the proposed 300-unit The Walk at East Village community have opened at the intersection of U.S. 70 Business and NC 42, next to the new apartments at Arbors at East Village, and the community will be hosting an open house April 22. It's a project that Joe Smith, president of Raleigh-based TIMU Group, says his team has worked on for several years, and they are optimistic that it will be embraced by their target audience in the 55-plus age category. Active adults are looking for a sense of community, and that's what we're trying to do with this project, Smith says. At The Walk at East Village, all of the detached houses and cottages will be arranged in pockets or clusters of 8 to 12 units facing a private shared courtyard or garden with connecting sidewalks. Most of the units, which range from 1,600 to 3,000 square feet, will still have garages accessible from the street, but with large front porches facing the communal areas to encourage social interaction with neighbors. The homes are priced from the $290,000 to $500,000. Smith says both he and one of his business partners, Devin Steele of Raleigh, have family living at Whidbey Island near Seattle, where they had first learned about pocket neighborhoods. Whidbey Island-based architect Ross Chapin has been championing the pocket neighborhood design concept since the late 1990s and has helped design multiple pocket neighborhoods in that region and consulted on many others across the U.S. We fell in love with the concept after we saw it, Smith says. Ross believes that traditional neighborhoods with front garages that open out to the street can make a neighborhood feel like a prison. You're isolated with no connection to the community. The only way people are going to talk to each other is if they are facing each other. Housing market remains strong in Triangle. Thanks to a double-digit growth bump in March, home sales were up nearly 11% in the first quarter in the Triangle as the market continues to walk the delicate line between buyer and seller demand and an inventory that's at historic lows. Inventory of available homes has kept at a stable 2 to 3 months of supply for the past 2 years, creating both opportunity and challenge for home sellers, says David Jones, president and chief operating officer of Coldwell Banker, Howard Perry, and Walston in Raleigh. The next few months will be noteworthy as we are ramping up for the summer selling season with significant demand and waning inventory due to seller hesitation, Jones says. Some homeowners have been reluctant to sell for fear they will not find an adequate replacement. While the market should remain steady through the next quarter, we anticipate the momentum to slow as prospective sellers are faced with the uncertainty of their next move and may choose to wait out another season in their current homes, he says. New Hyatt Place Hotel at Southern Village to open May 2nd. Chapel Hill's quaint Southern Village mixed-use community will soon be adding hotel amenities as it prepares for the May 2nd opening of its new Hyatt Place Hotel. The 110-room, five-story hotel is located near the entrance into Southern Village from U.S. 15501. It will be within walking distance of its Market Street merchants with Weaver Street Market, Lumina Theater, and other restaurants and businesses. Lennar pays $26 million for family-owned farm west of Apex. Lennar Carolinas has planted its largest flag yet in southern Wake County, acquiring a 225-acre family-owned farm west of Apex for its new multi-phased Smith Farms neighborhood community on Olive Chapel Road. The total price paid for the land assemblage, close to $25.7 million, ranks as one of the largest single-day land property takedowns in Triangle history. Lennar acquired the property from 11 members of the Smith family, including Staley Smith of Smith & Smith Surveyors in Apex, whose family has lived on the property since the late 1800s. A historic family home on Olive Chapel Road near the entrance into the new community is being restored and renovated and will be used as the community's main sales center once construction gets underway. New deals filling up North Hills office towers. Allscripts has begun the process of relocating all of its 1,400 employees based in Raleigh into the newly completed Midtown Plaza office building at North Hills as part of a flurry of deals beginning to fill each of the three office towers lining Six Forks Road at the I-440 Beltlines. Kane Realty has signed several deals that will bring the 17-story Cap Trust Tower and 18-story Bank of America Tower to nearly full occupancy. Enviva Partners of Maryland, Raleigh-based Delta Dental, and Eva Garland Consulting will open offices at Bank of America Tower. Sources say Optum, an arm of United Health Group, has taken another 36,000 square feet in the building. At CapTrust Tower, CapTrust Financial Advisors is expanding its space, taking another 6,565 square feet. Likewise, investment management firm NovaQuest Capital Management will expand its space in the building by 2,840 square feet. And now we turn to On Tech and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Kerry lands HQ for California company. House Bill 2 was just one factor Trilliant considered when deciding on its new global headquarters. That's according to Trilliant CEO Andy White, speaking April 18 after his California smart grid company announced it was relocating its global headquarters operation to Cary, a move that means 130 jobs in exchange for up to $1.3 million in state incentives. The company started with a small, stealthy satellite office here late last year. It was a handful of employees from the home office in California just testing the waters, White says. The initial plan was to start with an East Coast office, something the global company lacked, he explains, and the Cary team was assessing the Triangle landscape as executives in California would be evaluating Trilliant's options for a new headquarters. It was a long list at first, White says. Metros such as Boston, Atlanta, Tampa, Charlotte, and Nashville, Tennessee were on it alongside the Triangle. Then the list narrowed to three states, Florida, Tennessee, and North Carolina. HB2, described by its critics as discriminatory to the LGBT community, was part of the narrative. I met with the new governor right as he was coming into office, and especially moving people from very liberal California, we were concerned about this particular issue, White says, adding that it was one of several considerations. We looked at the overall mosaic of, is this a great place to live? Is it inclusive? Does it have the right cost of living? Are we going to be able to hire the right people? He won't say whether the House Bill 2 repeal made the deal possible. I'm really not sure. Every state has got their own pluses or minuses, he says, but he does call it progress toward inclusivity. There's still a ways to go, he says. Talent was a significant factor in the decision to pick the Triangle, White adds. Of the 130 jobs, about 30 are moving from California and other Trilliant sites, and 100 will be local hires. The company already has about a dozen people in Cary. Susan Sanford, executive director of the Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster, says the news further elevates the Triangle's place in clean tech. RTCC estimates the Triangle Clean Tech Company count is more than 350. Of those, more than 100 are specifically targeting the smart grid space, Trilliant's sweet spot. I think they were blown away by the depth and breadth of the grid companies here, she says. InterSouth Partners pulls back on making any new investments. News that the largest and one of the most prominent venture capital firms in the Triangle is no longer making investments in new companies is a big deal in the Triangle, an area continually touting its entrepreneurship prowess. While Durham's Inner South Partners is still funneling cash into its portfolio firms, its website confirms it's not looking for new investments. That also means the VC principals will not be raising any new money from its limited partners under the Inner South moniker. Inner South founder Dennis Doherty did not return repeated requests for comment. Inner South wasn't just about writing checks, says Merrill Mason, a partner at Smith Anderson Law Firm in Raleigh, focused on the entrepreneurship space. They also had a network of investors around the country to bring into those deals, he says. There was a significant multiplier effect. It's that aspect of InterSouth's strategy that may have bolstered the Triangle the most, says Monica Doss, principal of New City Ventures and former founding president of the Council for Entrepreneurial Development. Doss says CED wouldn't be here without InterSouth, and Doherty in particular. She credits him with figuring out the formula to court out-of-state investors. He had to be able to make a case. Back then, we didn't have anything. We didn't have these startups, she says. She adds that a key to the Triangle's entrepreneurial success isn't just how much venture capital you have, but who your venture capitalists are. Nine-story building on the rise on SAS campus in Cary. Cary-based SAS Institute is on track with the latest addition to its campus, a nine-story office building and training center that is currently under construction. The last beam for Building A was placed this month, says SAS spokeswoman Desiree Atkins. Construction is proceeding on schedule with plans for employees to move in Q1 2019, Atkins said in an email. SAS hosted a topping off event April 12 to commemorate the milestone, where officials and employees signed the final beam. Cary Mayor Harold Weinbrecht says the building will be one of the tallest, if not the tallest, buildings in Cary. He adds, "We are so fortunate to have such a great company like SAS in Cary." NCSU researchers have vision for a new vehicle. Imagine a colorful car whizzing over a custom track in the Research Triangle Park skyline. The futuristic cab would consume less power than a Tesla and further brand the Triangle as a place where innovation happens, proponents predict. A group of researchers at NC State University want to make it a reality, and they're looking for a partner with the footprint and wallet to back the idea. Seth Holler, an associate professor at NCSU and researcher on the project, says the second prototype vehicle of what's being called Echo PRT has been built. Now his team is looking for a Triangle company that might want to host a track on its campus. "Right now, we are actively looking for companies that would want to do a pilot run," he says, adding that conversations have already started with RTP companies. "It's ongoing discussions right now," Holler says. The vehicle, including its load, would weigh in at about 1,000 pounds. Car vending machine may be coming to Raleigh. Move over chips and candy, a new billboard over I-440 in Raleigh reads, "The car vending machine is coming." Aside from the billboard, Arizona-based Carvana isn't commenting on plans for Raleigh, where it has been operating a next-day delivery vehicle sales operation since 2015. But a trip to the site where a metal frame is rising offers hints at what's to come. So do public records, which show permits have been issued for a $2.5 million, 7,797-square-foot structure on Navajo Drive. If it's like other vending machines the company has built in places such as Austin, Texas, Carvana allows customers to collect cars they purchased online. And now we turn to On Life Sciences, written by Jennifer Henderson. The first headline, Chief Medical Officer Departs Argos. Argos problems stem from key oncology drug. Amid a turbulent last 2 months for Argos Therapeutics, the company's chief medical officer has resigned. Argos disclosed in an SEC filing April 14 that Dr. Lee Allen voluntarily resigned from the company effective April 13. There were no disagreements between Dr. Allen and the company or any officer or director of the company, which led to Dr. Allen's resignation, Argo stated in its filing, noting that Allen had served in the role since January 2016. Prior to joining Argos, Allen served as chief medical officer of Spectrum Pharmaceuticals and also held similar positions at companies such as AMAG Pharmaceuticals, Wyeth Research, and Pfizer, according to Argos. Troubles for Argos began in February when an independent data monitoring committee recommended the company discontinue a Phase 3 trial known as ADAPT of its lead oncology product candidate, Rocapodencel T, formerly known as AGS-003, for the treatment of metastatic kidney cancer. Following the recommendation to discontinue the trial, Argos announced plans to reduce its workforce by nearly 40% in early March and that it would need to raise capital to continue operations. The company cited bankruptcy as a possibility as well. The company also inked a lease for a new 40,000-square-foot manufacturing space at NC State University's Centennial Campus, but the company disclosed in late March that it had received a termination notice. RTP's G1 Therapeutics seeks up to $115 million. Research Triangle Park-based G1 Therapeutics has filed to raise up to $115 million in an initial public offering. The company stated April 13 that it plans to list its common stock on the NASDAQ exchange under the ticker symbol GTHX. According to an SEC filing, the company's largest stockholders are Hatteras Ventures Partner, 19.8%, Med Immune Ventures, 16.7%, Eshelman Ventures, 15.4%, RA Capital Healthcare Fund, 10.7%, and Lumera Capital, 7%. MERS-NA files sues former employees. Raleigh-based MERS North America Inc., which recently ushered in its new CEO, has filed a trade secrets lawsuit against a California medical device company and two of its employees who recently joined from MERS-NA. According to a complaint filed April 14 in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina, MERS-NA alleges that Sean Shapiro and Tracy Andora voluntarily departed senior sales positions at MERS-NA for Viviv Incorporated, a wholly owned subsidiary of Viviv Medical, and thus breached contracts and took with them trade secrets worth millions of dollars. The complaint further alleges that Viviv, quote, will market and sell, or is marketing and selling, unquote, products similar to MERS's Ultherapy skin lifting offering, and that MERS-NA, quote, believes that 6 of 10 of Viviv's current field employees came from MERS, all hired within the last months and directly away from MERS, unquote. It also alleges that in their roles at MERS-NA, Shapiro and Andora were privy to such information as customer relationships, sales and marketing strategies, pricing, strategic plans, manufacturing processes, compensation and commission strategies, and financial results. Through its actions, Viviv has sought to build its sales and marketing organization and strategy almost exclusively with MERS personnel and at MERS's expense rather than paying for the development of its own sales and marketing strategies, expertise, and sales personnel, the complaint states. This has caused MERS damages in the form of, among other things, lost services, lost revenues and profits, lost training costs, and subsequent recruitment costs, it continues. MERS-NA said in an email that it wants the improper targeting and recruiting of MERS employees to stop. We strongly believe this action is in the best interest of our organization and is necessary to protect our employees, MERS's proprietary marketing, and other business strategies, MERS-NA said. Patricia Scheller, CEO of Viviv, said the case is without merit and said the company would vigorously defend it. Reached by phone, Shapiro declined to comment on the lawsuit, and Andora did not return a request for comment. Back in 2014, MERS-NA announced the relocation of its headquarters to Raleigh from Greensboro, CEO Bob Radigan said in an interview that its intentions are to continue to expand its Raleigh operations. MERS NA is being represented in the lawsuit by Melissa Romanzo, Kurt Powell, and Robert Dumbacher of Hunton & Williams. Counsel for the defendants have yet to file appearances in the case. And now we turn to A Better World, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. His column is headlined, Interfaith Council Fills Orange County Gaps. Roughly one in five people who live in Orange County are poor, and many people who work at service jobs in the county cannot afford to live there. There's a huge disparity between haves and have-nots in Orange County, one of the most affluent counties in the state, says John Dorward, who just stepped down as co-director of the Interfaith Council for Social Service in Carrboro. And with state and federal government cuts looming in spending to address basic human needs, he says, demand for those services will only increase. Founded in 1963 by seven women from different churches who wanted to help close a gap they saw in services for people in need, the nonprofit today provides basic services for people living and working in Carrboro and Chapel Hill. Those services range from emergency financial support and crisis intervention to homeless shelters and a community kitchen, food pantry, and medical and dental clinic. The Interfaith Council operates with support from 50 to 60 churches, a staff of 19 full-time and 8 part-time employees, 750 volunteers, an annual budget of $1.9 million, plus in-kind gifts worth another $2.2 million to $2.4 million. In September 2015, it opened a 52-bed men's shelter at 1315 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Chapel Hill, replacing a smaller shelter in the former municipal building on West Rosemary Street. Now it is preparing for a campaign to raise $5.2 million to raise a building it owns at 110 West Main Street in Carrboro that houses its food pantry, crisis intervention services, and administrative offices, and build a new facility that will house those programs, as well as its community kitchen now located in the Rosemary Street building. The new facility, which would open near the end of 2020 and still needs approval from the town of Carrboro, would include a larger kitchen that would allow the Interfaith Council to offer classes in food, nutrition, and cooking, and to better recycle food in the community, says Dorward, who retired in 2015 as director after 13 years with the organization and returned as co-director last August. Succeeding him on April 10 was Jackie Jenks, former executive director at Hospitality House in San Francisco. The Interfaith Council also pairs volunteer support teams with individuals preparing to leave its homeless shelters for permanent housing. The teams help them as they move to independent living. The safety net has got lots of holes, and we are the bottom of the safety net, and we have to turn people away, says Dorward. With continued support from the community, we will look to strengthen the safety net wherever possible. And in nonprofit news, April is Parkinson's Awareness Month. Parkinson's is a disease that impacts approximately 30,000 North Carolinians, says a spokesman for the local chapter of the National Parkinson Foundation. The average age at diagnosis is 62, but it can strike people much younger. There is no cure, but there are treatments. The local Parkinson's Foundation will hold its fifth Moving Day North Carolina Triangle on October 1 at Carey's Cocobooth Amphitheater. The event is expected to draw 1,500 people, and those who want to help as sponsors or get involved with corporate walk teams can contact Blake Tedder at btedder@parkinson.org or at 919-241-4076. Clear it out. Want to get some documents shredded or get rid of computers and hard drives in a secure way? You can on the morning of April 22 in Raleigh when the Better Business Bureau of Eastern North Carolina partners with Coastal Federal Credit Union. Community members can get documents shredded for free and drop off electronics for recycling or secure destruction. And in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal, there's also a special section Triangle Business Journal Women in Business Awards. There's a long list of winners, but we will read the Lifetime Achievement, the headline, Still Making a Difference After Career at Duke Energy. And this is written by Cameron Snipes. Hilda Pinnix Ragland has blazed a trail for women and African Americans in the corporate and civic arenas in the Triangle, a career with an enduring legacy that earned her this year's Lifetime Achievement Award for Women in Business. I am very, very appreciative of this wonderful award, she says. Armed with an accounting degree from North Carolina A&T State University and an MBA from Duke University, Pinnix Ragland began her career as an accountant and later served as a senior auditor at Arthur Andersen. She joined Progress Energy in 1997 and served the company in various roles, including manager of corporate community relations, vice president of economic development, and VP of energy delivery services. Prior to Progress's merger with Duke Energy in 2012, Pinnix Ragland was VP of corporate public affairs, a role she continued after the merger closed. In that role, she worked with officials at the federal, state, and local levels to develop public policy that protects consumers and businesses. She was also responsible for working with Duke Energy's International Interests on Energy initiatives for broad-reaching policy positions with stakeholder organizations. She retired last June. Pinnix Ragland continues to serve on a number of boards. She currently serves on RTI International's Board of Directors and was chair of the board of the American Association of Blacks in Energy. She is also past chair of the North Carolina State Board of Community Colleges and member of the National Association of Corporate Directors. Pinnix Ragland is also involved in furthering STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math education. She leads an annual STEM Academy at a local elementary school and is now in the program's third year. Education is at the forefront for me, Pinnix Ragland says. Pinnix Ragland is also striving for equality in social circles. In 2013, she and her husband Alvin were named members of Raleigh's Carolina Country Club, the first African-American members in the club's 103-year history. And I think we will have more, she says. You open up doors and don't look back. She is a recipient of the 2007 James E. Stewart Award, the highest award given each year by the American Association of Blacks in Energy. She was also awarded the prestigious Education Award for Leadership in Community Colleges from former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. And in 2012, Savoy Magazine recognized Pinnix Ragland as one of the top 100 influential women in corporate America. Company description: Duke Energy, Diversified Utility. Education: Bachelor of Science in Accounting, North Carolina A&T State University. MBA, Duke University. Graduate Program, Kennedy School of Public Policy, Harvard University. What accomplishments are you most proud of from the past year? Retirement and my new invigorating career. What is your professional goal 5 years from now? Corporate board director and additional boards, author, 40% increase in Pinnix pecans. What is the most difficult obstacle you faced in business? Sudden death of our CEO, Bob McGeehee, from a stroke in 2007 and transition to rural county economic development. To what cause or charity are you most committed? Education for all students, HPR STEM Academy, community colleges, North Carolina Community Foundation, and NCA&T State University. What female business person or leader do you admire most? Carla Harris, Vice Chair, Morgan Stanley, an author, teacher, singer, and friend. If you could change one thing about the Triangle, what would it be? A mass transit system. Finish the sentence. Government, local, state, or federal, can help my business organization only if the federal government continues to sustain a strategic investment in the world's overall education, health, and economic success. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the guest column written by Lisa Mitnick, who is a managing director of Accenture Digital, leading North America Internet of Things sales. The headline, Closing Gender Pay Gap Within Reach. New research from Accenture reveals that women graduating in the class of 2020 in the United States could be the first generation to close the pay gap within their professional lifetimes. This can be achieved 36 years ahead of current projections by 2044 by making key adjustments in the types of skills women acquire and how they manage their careers, along with critical support from government, business, and academia. The pay gap is an important measure of the imbalances in the labor market today. Women are a vital resource in the race to fill the global demand for talent, but they remain woefully underrepresented in the workforce and continue to earn less than men. This robs women, their families, and communities of income, skills, and education, and deepens social inequality. Accenture's research found that globally, a woman earns an average $100 for every $140 a man earns. According to this imbalance is the fact that women are much less likely than men to have paid work, 50% and 76% respectively. This contributes to a hidden pay gap that increases the economic inequities between men and women. For every $100 a woman earns, a man earns $258, the research shows. The research also identifies several critical factors that affect a woman's ability to achieve equal pay as early as her freshman year in college. Female undergraduates are currently less likely than their male counterparts to choose an area of study that they believe offers high earning potential, 21% versus 39%, have a mentor, 45% versus 78%, or aspire to senior leadership positions, 42% versus 57%. Young women are less likely than their male counterparts to adopt new technologies quickly, 39% versus 73%, and take coding and computing courses, 69% versus 90%. That last statistic is perhaps the most troubling. Despite clear evidence of the benefits of tech experience and STEM education, women are not seizing the opportunity early enough. I see high school and college-age women lose their passion for STEM classes because being good in math and science stops being cool, or the courses become difficult, or they find themselves isolated in predominantly male classes without a support group. This is the time when we need to step in and offer support, serve as role models and mentors, and encourage them to persevere. We need to help them understand that their investment in these classes comes with a very high return on investment, literally and figuratively. There are three powerful accelerators that are most likely to get more women into paid work, help them progress, and ultimately help them close the pay gap. These include developing digital fluency, having a proactive career strategy, and becoming immersed in technology. Globally, combining these three strategies could reduce the pay gap by 35% by 2030. Women cannot do it alone. Collaboration is critical. Demographics are changing today's workforce as much as technology, and at the heart of this evolution is women's rise into the modern workforce and the ranks of leadership, and their demands for greater flexibility in where, when, and how they work. Business, government, and academia all have an important role to play. Collaboration is key to providing the right opportunities, environments, and role models to lead the way for change, from ensuring internet access as a basic right of every citizen to attracting non-working women to the workplace. Equal Pay Day on April 4 provided an opportunity to demonstrate our commitment to helping women achieve their career goals beyond research findings or words of encouragement. We take great pride in supporting programs that encourage young women to gain tech skills like Girls Who Code and Code.org. The future workforce must be an equal workforce. The gender pay gap is an economic and competitive imperative that matters to everyone, and the faster we can close it, the healthier our workforce and our economies will be. The class of 2020 stands to be a major beneficiary of these changes if they can realize the opportunity before them and seize it. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Inner South's Journey Paved Area's Startup Ecosystem. No business can survive without money. Well, some can, but with other people's money. But companies that are inventing and building things need money to make money. In the late 1960s, to bolster entrepreneurism in the U.S., some smart people from California pooled resources from rich individuals and created funds to assist the creative class into building things and crafting services that eventually were tethered to the way we live today. That process gave birth to venture capital, money used to support ventures. In the past few days, we learned Durham's Inner South Partners, the largest and the oldest venture capital firm in the Triangle, will not be making any new investments because the firm will not be raising a new fund. It will still continue to support its existing portfolio where necessary from the remaining cash it has left in its funds. In all, the company invested almost $800 million across 7 venture capital partnerships in 32 years, with the majority of money going to companies in the Triangle, North Carolina, and the Southeast. Local companies such as OpenSight Technologies, Acipiter, Paradigm Genetics, and many others got money in the early days from InnerSouth to become successful. Many would say InnerSouth's lead partners, Dennis Doherty and Mitch Mumma, have squashed the hopes of more entrepreneurs than the ones they made happy. Over the years, I have heard complaints relating how the Triangle's venture capital firms, including InnerSouth, devalue companies when deciding the amount to invest and post-deal ownership stake. But let's not forget one simple thing. Had it not been for Doherty, Mumma, Art Pappas of Pappas Ventures, and a few others in the area, we would not have an entrepreneurial ecosystem. Today, that same ecosystem is spreading. And we'll stop there, but he does go on to say that hopefully InnerSouth Partners will start a new fund, but eventually someone else will fill that role. And one thing in business is that nothing lasts forever. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.